Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. Our guest this evening is Ira Fuchs, the writer of an exciting, poignant new play called Vilna, about the rise of the Vilna ghetto against the superior Nazi forces. It's a play that talks about the humanity and the monstrosity of the human race. It shows the complexities of humans, how at the same time we can be very selfish, we can be very monstrous, and yet be very human. In the play, in one of the scenes, as a matter of fact, in a couple of scenes, you can see the terrible choice of having to choose who will be sent in the Nazi wagons, the point of playing God and decide, mi ichye u mi yomus, who will live and who will die, is not a choice that any human would envy. Ira Fuchs, for many years, was in IT. He had his own company, which he conducted successfully until he retired, and then he went back to the love of the theater, which he had since a very early age. Good evening, Ira.
Good evening, Chaim. Thank you very much for inviting me to this radio show. It is an honor and a privilege to address your audience.
The honor, the privilege is all ours. Thank you. So tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you get to write a play? And B, why of all the things you could have written, why something about the Holocaust?
Well, I didn't make a conscious choice to do this. This was something that was, if I may say, imposed on me by a greater authority. And the way it happened is that I was enrolled in a playwriting workshop down at Holland University in the summer of 2016. It was an MFA program where I was a non-matriculated graduate student, and one of the courses, which took place over 6 weeks instead of the usual 3 months, was called First Drafts. I had to write six plays in 6 weeks. We would get prompts on a Thursday, and we had to turn in a full-length play on a Sunday. The second assignment was to find an article that day in the newspaper and write a play based on it. And that day, July 29th, 2016, was the article in the New York Times. The author was Nicholas St. Fleur, and it was the discovery and corroboration of a tunnel dug out of the Ponar killing pits outside of Vilna. Now, back in 1939-40, when Russia occupied the area and were on the verge of war with Germany, there was a non-aggression pact temporarily. But when the Russians came in and occupied that part of Poland, in the Ponar Forest, they dug a number of pits, about two dozen pits. Deep pits that were basically about 8 to 10 meters deep and about 20 meters wide. It was, no one really knew what it was for, the storage of most likely fuel. And when the Nazis arrived, they discovered these pits, and this is where they shot and killed 70,000 Jews and others over a 2.5 year period. They never burned the bodies, though, because you would have smelled it. At towards the end of 1943, with the Russians advancing and overcoming the Nazis, remember, this was right at the border of Russia. It's northeastern Europe. Mm-hmm. They realized that they had a criminal liability with having all of those bodies. It was proof. They got 80 Jews, shackled them, put them in the pits, and had them exhume and burn the bodies over a 4 or 5 month period of time. About a half a dozen to a dozen of us dug out a tunnel. Yudi Farber, an actual person, was the engineer. Mutke Zeidel, an actual person, was one of the people who escaped. Now, Mutke Zeidel and both Yudi Farber escaped. In my play, Yudi Farber does not. He is shot. But Mutke Zeidel was an actual person. After he escaped, he joined the partisans. He then went to Israel and lived a very nice, long life till he was about 84, 85, Hetchum. Mm-hmm. Always claimed that this happened. For 40 years, claim that this happened could never prove it. And in 2016, a team of archaeologists under the auspices of Professor Richard Freund from the University of Harvard, who is coming to my April 7th performance, as well as a team of archaeologists from Canada under Paul Bauman, who will be at that on the March 24th performance, they used a X-ray tomography technique and discovered it and started to take it out, dig it. And there was the proof and there was the article. And after the article, there was a PBS documentary on it. The producers of the PBS documentary are coming to my April 7th performance as well. I have had the privilege of being able to make the connections to all of these people that did this incredible thing, because this is one of the very important things. Vilna was ground zero for the Nazi final solution. It was the first place they came for a number of reasons. One, it was the railway hub that connected Eastern and Western Europe. Number two, it was a significant manufacturing. There were literally heavy equipment manufacturers in Vilna. Mm-hmm. It had a tremendously talented workforce. They were all Jews. And half the population of about 140,000 people were Jews. Never in the history of the diaspora, before or after, has there been one place with that demographic density of Jews unique. And that's where they came, because it was right on the border. And so it was the old-fashioned way of killing them. Put them in the pits, shoot them. So it's a piece of history that is important, but it is not just the escape from the tunnel. I did a significant amount of research, and what I really, really became impressed with is what the Jews under the Judenrat did to preserve the humanity and the dignity and the infrastructure of society, even under the worst horrendous conditions. And the true heroism to me is not about picking up a gun. It's about preserving the fabric of civilization. Absolutely. Under any circumstances. And that's one of the stories in this play. There are a number of stories in this play, but this is about how to be a real human being. And the question that I have had constantly, and that I hope other people will have, is what would I do? Because I consider myself privileged. I consider myself very lucky, having been born where I was born, in the time that I was born, to the parents that I was born, to all of the opportunities that I have had. I consider myself fortunate that I have not faced tremendous adversity in my life, difficult like everybody else. And number three is, I think I'm soft. I don't know my core. I don't know what I would do if I was in that situation.
Well, the secret of any great play, the secret of any work of art, is that it makes you think. You always try to find, what would I have done? How would I have reacted? How does it relate to me? And this play certainly does accomplish that. You leave that and you look at the various characters. Each one of them has his flaws. There isn't a perfect saintly person over here. And yet, when it comes to the point of having to do something, they all transcend the person they were before the new circumstances presented themselves. They all grew, for the good or for the bad. Even the villains grow in this play. Mm-hmm. And that's what I find so hauntingly beautiful. That's what I find, that rather than presenting the facts in a melodramatic way that makes you want to cry, that makes you want to scream, everything is done in a subdued way. Mm-hmm. And it's up to you, to your mind, to try to understand the horror, to try to find the humanity, to try to understand the villains.
And I think that True heroism is quiet.
Of course.
And I hope also that people realize that, and they will realize, that this is a cautionary tale. One of the very interesting the statistics that I discovered is that in Germany, in 1930, 67 million people lived in Germany. The number of Jews was 0.7%, less than 500,000 people. Mm-hmm. If you didn't live in Dresden, Munich, or Berlin, you never found a Jew in Germany. Couldn't be there. Now, most people, most wars and strife, financial contention, geographic resource contention, ethnic tension, that didn't exist with the Jews. The Jews were a non-entity in Germany. They provided no significant threat to the general population or the state. There was no reason, basis in fact, for there to be persecution and the murder of Jews.
Well, throughout history in Europe, even though we were a tiny fraction of the total population of any given country, the fact is, whether through religious zealotry, through plain wish for political gain, the Jews were always the scapegoats for everything.
And
that's our history.
Yes, and part of the cautionary tale of this play is that it can still happen again and anywhere.
Absolutely.
Steven Spielberg, about a month ago, was asked, are you concerned? He says, yes, I am. Now, what is the parallels between 1930 that allowed a madman who had an emotional issue with Jews, okay, and went all over the world to eradicate them while they posed virtually no threat whatsoever and were always a asset, to, is that you had a dictator. So remember, Germany was a republic in 1930, mm-hmm. and Hitler was elected. He became part of the Reichstag, and certain events took place that were probably fabricated that resulted in emergency measures, the Reichstag laws. And mm-hmm. once the emergency measures were taken place, Hitler became a dictator. And at that point, for that to have happened, you had to have a legislative branch fall behind him. And that's exactly what happened. It wasn't just Hitler. There were collaborators in the legislative branch. And just while I was writing this and as I became aware of how it happened, it just is the sensibility that I have, my own personal sensibility, which I don't impose on anybody else. But for myself, I have a level of anxiety about American society and democracy and my health and well-being as a Jew, mm-hmm. you know, is to me at risk.
Okay, and not just from one side, unfortunately.
I get it.
If it was only from one side, it's relatively easy.
Absolutely.
In
this
fact,
is complicated.
If we go back to Jewish history, on the other hand, the greatest empires conquered us, decimated us, did their utmost to destroy us, and yet, like a phoenix, every time we managed to rise up. In the 50s, Professor Arnold Toynbee, at the time the foremost historian, a British professor, in his book, A Study of History, he called the Jews the fossil of history. Because if you follow all the rules of history, we should have disappeared thousands of years ago. There should have been no such thing as a Jew today. Even by Hitler's time, there shouldn't have been a single Jew left. And yet, long after the good professors' learned tomes will be forgotten and relegated to the dustbin of history, we'll still be here, and nobody will be able to destroy us, no matter how much of our blood is shed, no matter how much they try their best to finish us off.
Yep. And we are, the research also around Poland. So Jews lived in the capital of Poland in the beginning of the 10th century. They were always there. Now, Poland, by the 20th century, had roughly 3.5 million Jews out of 35 Absolutely. Million, the highest density anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that the Jews, particularly in the 15th and 16th century, were invited by the nobility, the Jagiellon dynasties. Poland was a serfdom, okay? You had the nobility, it was the Holy Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. The nobility functioned under the auspices of the church, right. Papal seat. And there was tension between the nobility and the papal seat because the nobility invited the Jews, solicited Jews to come
right.
because they could read, they could write, they could do math,
they could build business. It was for economics.
And they needed that because even the nobility, for the most part, were substantially illiterate.
Absolutely.
And the serfs were completely illiterate. So the Jews in the 15th century began to build the modern Polish state. The church resisted this.
Absolutely.
And they fought with the nobility all the time. And the nobility said, yeah, but we need them.
One of the tragic ironies of history is that after the Spanish Inquisition started and the Jews fled Spain, those who did not ostensibly convert and become Marranos, one of the safest places for a Jew was any of the German principalities. Germany was not a unified country. It was a connection of principalities. Today, I, as a prince, was fighting you, my next-door neighbor. Tomorrow, the two of us were fighting the other guy, and so on and so forth. In order to be able to do that, they needed the merchants. They needed the financial brains. You can't fight a war with just weapons. You need somebody to direct it financially. Otherwise, after a short while, you're out of business. You can't fight, no matter your might. And yet, in spite of all those centuries, 4 or 5 centuries, of doing well in Germany, in spite of the occasional anti-Semitism, in spite of the fact that many professions were closed to Jews, when Hitler rose and an American, Michael Tress, went to Germany to warn the German Jews, the German Jews were so secure in Germany that they said they don't mean us, they mean the Ostjuden, the Eastern Jews. And yet they were among the first to be taken down. One of my professors at Yeshiva University, the head of the political science department, was one of the 2 Jewish socialist members of the Reichstag before the war, Dr. Joseph Duner. And he tells us some of the stories how they were warned many times, and nobody wanted to believe it. It didn't make a difference if you were a left-wing Jew, if you're a right-wing Jew. Hey, we were more Germans than the German. The Jewish soldiers during World War I had among them more decorations given by the German government for heroism than all the Germans together.
That brings up the subject of denial. And denial is such a powerful thing. So what is denial? Denial is being faced or confronted with a certain set of facts or information and rejecting it. So some of the denial, even when there was the ghetto, and it was that bad, people were escaping from the Pona pit were not shot, who missed being shot. They would crawl out of the Pona pit, come back to the ghetto and say, this is happening. And people wouldn't believe them.
As a matter of fact, Abba Kovner, who is mentioned in the play, he wrote the first manifesto ever written by a target of the Nazis, saying that the Nazis intended to kill every Jew in Europe and then in the rest of the world. And of course, nobody believed them at first.
And that's in my play. I have a
yes.
whole scene.
Yes.
And I quote Kovner verbatim. So that's I used his speech
Absolutely.
Verbatim.
And nobody believed him. In fact, when Hitler wrote Mein Kampf, they said it was the rantings of a madman. Nobody believed that such a thing could ever happen. They could have stopped him before he became the infamous Hitler.
So the denial also shows up in my play a lot, right? People...
That's what makes it so human, so lifelike.
Now, this is what's so interesting about the way the Germans showed up. They didn't just show up with a bunch of troops and machine guns and mow everybody down. They did everything with tremendous stealth, quietly. They recruited hundreds of Lithuanians, militia, and had them work in teams of two as abduction squads. They never had the same two people on the same block on different days, and they would abduct somebody on the way to work or some on the way home, but quietly. They had people who, provocateurs, who staged events and blamed them on Jews. Again, everything was done and orchestrated in a way so that you could never really tell what was happening. And the Germans were in the background. The Nazis were in the background.
Of course, whenever denying they could get somebody else to do the dirty work, it was great.
And this created a lot of dissonance in the people. And it's like, how are people disappearing? We're getting postcards from them. And this is important to understand that this has to be planned and engineered.
Absolutely.
And that's what happened. I was very interested in being able to portray the way it was done and how it happened. We tend to not examine the details of the execution of these things, but I particularly found it fascinating.
It is. But at the same time, like I said at the beginning, it being presented in a very subtle way without the horrors in front of our eyes actually makes the horror that much greater.
The other thing is that all of the Einsatzgruppen who were really not Einsatzgruppen, I can never get it right, you know, they became part of the permanent governing overs. Mm-hmm. They became attached. They were profiting. They generated huge fortunes, you know, from the industry of the Jews,
yeah.
Even in the ghetto. And Bruno Kittel, who was brought in to finally liquidate towards the end of the war, a 21-year-old drama student, you know, from Berlin, very effete, very cultured. Never found them. They never found them. If you look them up, there's nothing about what happened after the war. And he basically probably went down to South America somewhere with a
changed
fortune,
names or
changed
whatever.
His name, and sure. Started a theater company.
Probably. Unfortunately, that's the problem with the human creature. On the one hand, it can be a very beautiful creature. On the other hand, it can be a very horrible, monstrous creature. On the one hand, what makes us human is both the inner strength and the outer weakness. Otherwise, we're not human.
And one of the other Eisengruppen, Martin Weiss, you know, a butcher, his prior background, he wasn't a military guy. He was just a civilian. He was a worker. I think it was a... I forget what his profession was, and he worked on a farm, he had family. He was a citizen. He was a model citizen by all accounts of people who knew him. Never had showed any inclination for sociopathic behavior. And put him in this uniform, bring him here, and he became a monster. So what happens to people?
Well, for many years in Israel, while I lived in Israel, where I met my wife, an American, I left America to go to Israel to marry an American, of course. Anyway, when I was in the Israeli Reserve Forces, when I put on the uniform, my mode of thinking was totally different. Mm. There were guys in my unit, university professors, doctors, The moment we put on the uniform, we were different people. You didn't even have to hold a gun. You were different people. You became an automaton. You were a machine. You were not a human. You didn't have time to be human. When you have the enemy shooting at you, you don't have time to start thinking. You have to act automatically. That's part of the uniform. Years ago, around the time I was still in college, there was a very famous movie, A Shop on Main Street. In the opening scene, you see this guy in what looks like a uniform, a military uniform, in a very comfortable home, with his kids, playing with his kids, the ideal father. Any kid would have loved to have such a father. In one of the scenes, little girl looks at the aquarium and she sees her favorite fish is dead. She starts crying. He goes to see why she's crying and he cries with her. In the next scene, he's helping his wife. Not only an ideal father, an ideal husband. The next morning, you see him at work, a monster in the concentration camp. That's what I mean by the complexity of the human mind. None of us is absolutely good or absolutely evil. Even a monster has some semblance of humanity in it. Even a saint has some semblance of sadism in it.
Talk about saints. So in my play during the Passover scene, we put on the radio and Cardinal Hollande, H-L-O-N-D, comes up and gives this truly anti-Semitic, rabid speech. That cardinal is up for sainthood right now.
That's right. In fact, a lot of the priests who were collaborators with the Nazis in apprehending Jews are suddenly the great heroes in Lithuania. And in fact, the Lithuanians are conducting a campaign that the only reason they fell under the Nazi boot was because of the Jews. Therefore, it is the Jews' fault that they were under the Nazis in World War II. A complete reversal of the actual thing. But understandably, nobody ever wants to admit that he or she is culpable of whatever it is. We always try to whitewash it, or we couldn't live with ourselves.
The endless moral ambiguity.
Absolutely.
Is just something that is so difficult always to get your head around. I use the term sentimental morality several times in my play. And it's, you know, you want to wake up every day and feel that you're capable of being the best possible person that you're capable of being. On the other hand, you never know until you're really tested and put in positions where your what you believe is your convictions are really tested.
Absolutely.
And like I said, from writing this play, I'm less sure about myself than I've ever been.
Whenever we are in a position that we are totally unaccustomed to, that's when we either rise to the person we were meant to be, or we descend to the monster we never should have been. It's very hard. May we never be tested.
I've been very lucky, because I haven't been tested.
Neither have I. As the son of Holocaust survivors, I never met my siblings, or my uncles, my aunts, my cousins for that matter. I heard many, many stories, and I always wondered, how would I have acted? I have the same dilemma you do. Okay, thank you very, very much. This was very enlightening, very interesting. I learned a lot from the play. I learned a lot from talking to you. Thank you very, very much. It was a pleasure talking to you, Ira.
Thank you. It's a pleasure having this conversation. I hope people will come see the play. I do believe that now that we are three generations removed from the Holocaust and we have few survivors left to bear testimony, that theater, because of its immediacy and its liveness, it is the very most effective proxy for conveying the intellectual and emotional incomprehensibility of the Holocaust.
Absolutely.
And if you want to have the type of visceral experience that you would have had by through the stories of an actual survivor, the incontrovertible proof of it. In lieu of not having this, theater delivers that experience. So please come see the play.
Every evening at 7 o'clock at the St. Clements Theater, 423 West 46 in Manhattan. Thank you very much. Good night, one and all.